You're with Sounds Good on WKMS. I'm your host, Tracy Ross. I'm pleased to be joined in the studios now by Dr. Kenneth Tucker, Professor Emeritus of Murray State University's Department of English and Philosophy. Dr. Tucker, thanks for being on the show today.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You've added yet another novel to your list of published titles. This one's called Hell is Where the Heart Is, which you describe as an unabashed farce about behind-the-scenes events at a state university. It's now available to the public. So, Dr. Tucker, you've been at three universities.
Yes,
if I'm correct, you taught here for 31 years, and you've been retired from here for 12 years.
Right,
so you've spent enough time in the university setting to definitely know the ins and outs enough to write a book. But also, do you feel that since you've been away for a dozen years, you also now have the distance to write a book like this?
Somewhat, I suppose. As I say, I don't really keep up with the immediate university events. Of course, the recent controversy I'm aware of, but usually it's sort of away from it, and you sort of look back on it and look upon similarities of things that have happened at Murray State and other universities I've been at as a student and as a grad assistant and so forth.
I'm going to read a description of this book because it kind of threw me for a tizzy when I read it a few moments ago. It says, in the newest book, Biff Cogan, a minor league administrator at a state university, glum in a dead-end position, sells his soul to the devil to become the university's president. Professing that he has shortchanged his latest client, the devil adds to the bargain, Biff's dream girl, a 1920s big band singer who only Biff recalls because he has one of her few surviving scratchy 78 RPM records. Gleefully, Biff looks to the future but learns that deals with the devil are not what they seem. It has a cast of thousands, including Napoleon, Nero, Mata Hari, Genghis Khan, and Dutch Schultz, along with a trip to the netherworld that Dante never took. That is quite a mouthful, Dr. Tucker. Where did these ideas come from?
I don't know. I wish I knew myself. It just, I sort of get a rough idea of what a plot is, and sometimes they may linger for years. In fact, I first thought of this one maybe 35 years ago, but it just started going into fruition maybe a couple of years ago, and it's just, I sort of get a basic idea, and then things sort of take over. I've never been one to sit down and write out a detailed plot summary in advance.
Is this your first farce?
I suppose so. I've written a series of comic novels that are on this type about the Kentucky Colonel in Darkest Africa and a Kentucky Colonel in King Arthur's Court, which are sort of comic fantasies. They're adventure tales, but yet done humorously at the same time and with jokes in them and so forth.
You grew up on Spike Jones, Mad Magazine, Gilbert and Sullivan, Aristophanes. Talk about how your experiences influence your approach to a farce.
Well, I think it's all of this is sort of sunk into my subconscious, I suppose, as I was growing up. I used to listen to the records of Spike Jones and Homer and Jethro and so forth. I don't know if a lot of people may not be familiar with them today, but they were parodists. Spike Jones and his band would play washboards and ooga horns and shoot off guns during a parody of a popular tune or so forth. And Homer and Jethro made their parodies. And, of course, I was probably a first-generation reader of Mad Magazine. I remember the days when it was a comic book when it first came out, you see. So I used to read that when I was a teenager, and I got into college. I got interested in the Aristophanes and Gilbert and Sullivan and so forth and their type of farcical writings, and I suppose it's they all sort of are rumbling around in my unconscious and sort of come out. I think one thing I realized when I was writing this, that Gilbert and Sullivan, one of the comic things in their characters, that the characters always come out and are the clowns, usually tell what they are, reveal what they are, like the famous ones of Joseph Porter, who's the head of the Queen's Navy, tells how he was sort of a lick spittle and a cave in and so forth as he worked his way up. You know, he comes out and obviously tells the audience this in a song. He doesn't hide it. It's like what most people would hide, you know, that he was sort of a yes man and so on. He just comes out and announces it. And I play a lot with this, people blurting out their real selves, let's say.
many authors have basically a proxy for themselves in each of their books. Is there any Ken Tucker in Biff Kogan?
No, I don't think so. Well, that's somewhat different. I suppose there is. Yes, I think there are some things that I would have in common with him. I sometimes lose my temper, of course, and so forth. And he, of course, I don't go into rages and kick dolls downstairs or strangle teddy bears. Is one of the things I have him do in the book. But you know, but I think in certain ways, because we all want success in certain ways and so forth. But he goes about it in ways that most of us would think are unscrupulously.
When you write, do you feel a responsibility to really see every character's point of view, at least enough to be able to write that character honestly, or do you feel that in each book there are only a handful of characters that really you're telling the narrative through and the rest are kind of window dressing?
That's usually the case, I think, with most writing. You sort of fully characterize some. But with this, of course, it's completely different. You know, it's not meant to be realistic. It's a farce, so you deal in exaggeration and sort of lampooning of things. And things are, you know, blown out of proportion. But, you know, as I say, they're blown out of proportion from things that really do exist.
There's a Jonathan Swift quote that I understand is very important to you. It says, "I have ever hated all nations, professors, and communities." Or is that professions? I can't read it.
Professions, right. I think.
"All nations, professions, and communities, and all my love is toward individuals." Uh-huh. Now, on its face value, that's a fairly easy quote to understand. But how does that inform your writing and your approach to writing?
Well, I think it was a letter that he wrote to Alexander Pope, and talking about his idea of satire, he's sort of he's not condemning everybody in a particular group, like all university administrators or members of the Board of Regents or something like this, or I'm not, but he said, or all English professors. I have some English professors who come in for drubs too, but I'm just saying, you know, he was saying that from his point of view, groups, most of groups are going to have bad people in it or unworthy people, but when I'm criticizing a group, I'm not necessarily saying all are like this, because I do like individuals within it. I think he says something like, "Well, I dislike judges as a whole, but I like judge so and so or lawyer so and so." So he's drawing a distinction, saying I'm not really condemning a whole group of people, and one shouldn't think that necessarily.
So what's on the horizon for you bookwise? Do you have another idea that's already in the works, or what can we expect coming up in the future?
Well, one is going to sort of step on the toes of this one is one I've called The Player Gods, which I wrote back in 1980s before I had to rework it into a modern format, and this is completely opposite. It's sort of like a 260-page nightmare, let's say, where a fellow wakes up with a name that nobody's ever heard and finds he's a private detective, but he doesn't remember his past. And the story could be, it starts out as a detective story, but it could be a story of witchcraft, or it could be a story of his insanity, or the story of, it could be science fiction, it could be time travel involved, or alternate universes, or an alien invasion, and he doesn't know what's going on, and some of the others don't either. So that's about the strangest thing I've ever written, I think, as well.
That sounds pretty fascinating. You're saying that's the strangest thing you've ever written after I've read the description.
This one, they're both strange. but that's more of a horror type thing with some sort of a quasi allegory too, I guess, with dealing with scientific advances and so forth.
You're a prolific reader as well as a writer. Are there any particular authors whose work you keep gravitating toward?
Of course, naturally Shakespeare and the writers of his era. That was my specialty when I was here. But you know, I like Faulkner quite a bit. I keep going back to him. And Tolstoy, I suppose, is Anna Karenina, is my favorite novel of all time, really. There's quite a number of them, and I will hop back to poets, T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden, Yeats, and so forth.
You have reviewed plays for the Shakespeare newsletter, and does studying the form even if it's a different form than you're working in, a play versus a book, seeing the form and reviewing the form of a play, does that help you as far as structuring your books as a writer? Do you learn any lessons?
Oh, I think so. I think a lot of that will so maybe if you don't really conscientiously say, you know, you base it on something, it's sort of there, you know, it influences you the types of structure and so forth. And particularly, I guess sometimes like Elizabethan plays sometimes would have paralleling structures or scenes or subplots, and sometimes I think I've probably inherited a tendency to do that sometimes from having read so many of those plays in the past.
Do you have a favorite Shakespeare play?
It'd be between Hamlet and Antony and Cleopatra.
Really? Not many people would say Antony and Cleopatra, probably, if you were to ask them that. What is it about that work that speaks to you?
It's very complex, and it's just difficult to... It sees the good and bad in both sides, and, you know, it sort of shows the complexity of these events. Antony and Cleopatra are destructive, yet there's something noble in their love for each other. So you have this sort of paradox, you know, that you can't quite put a label on it. And it's sort of intriguing that works like that tend to intrigue me, where you the sort of both sides of something are shown.
Dr. Kenneth Tucker, a professor emeritus at Murray State University's latest book is Hell Is Where the Heart Is. A paperback version of the book is available at Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and other online dealers. It's also available on Kindle and other e-readers. And locally, you can find the book at the Murray State University store in the Kerr Center on campus and at Merchants Mall on Highway 94 East. Dr. Tucker, thanks for spending some time with us today on Sounds Good.
Well, I certainly thank you.